From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Yesterday, an Iraqi Scud missile hit a residential section of Tel Aviv. Iraq's ambassador to the UN said his country was inflicting the pain and suffering of war on Israel to get them to reach a settlement with the Palestinians. Why are the Palestinians aligned with Iraq, and how divided are Palestinians over that alliance? On today's Fresh Air, we ask Middle East historian Rashid Khalidi, author of several books on the Palestinians. Also today, three artists respond to the Gulf War. Dissident poet Dabia Khamis joins us from Cairo. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Galway Kinnell reads a poem he wrote as the war began. And editorial cartoonist Dan Wasserman finds the dark humor in the first week of war. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House has denied a report from Baghdad that Allied bombers attacked an Iraqi baby food factory. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the plant was actually making biological weapons. He charged that the Iraqis had attempted to disguise the plant's military purposes behind a facade of producing baby formula. The report of the bombing came in a censored broadcast from Baghdad today by CNN correspondent Peter Arnett. Arnett said he'd been taken to the area and shown a seemingly innocent factory. An informal Israeli request for $13 billion in additional U.S. aid is getting an initial warm reception from the Bush administration. Praising Israel, Secretary of State James Baker says the U.S. appreciates the restraint shown by Israel. But Baker also says Israeli retaliation against Iraq might not hurt the coalition. Barry Schwide reports from the State Department.
Baker, approached by reporters after signing a science agreement with the Mongolian foreign minister, became the first Bush administration official to declare that if Israel retaliated against Iraq, it might not hurt the coalition. Some Arab governments already have acknowledged Israel's right to defend itself, but Baker stressed how much the administration appreciates that Israel has held its fire. Asked then about an unofficial Israeli request for $13 billion in additional U.S. economic aid over 5 years, Baker said he'd have to get the details, but he said the request would be considered and that the U.S. is proud of the assistance it has given Israel over the years. Baker's remarks reflect a general warming in relations with Israel. Disputes over settlements on the West Bank and Israel's tactics in containing Palestinian outbreaks have faded away, at least for now. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Two leading Jewish groups today joined a call by Arab American leaders for the FBI to end a controversial anti-terrorist program that includes questioning Arab Americans. Michael Richards reports.
The issue is one of constitutional and civil rights at a time of war. The FBI has been singling out Arab American business and community leaders, reportedly to ask them about political views and to request that if they know anything about terrorism, to please come forth. Arab American leaders say this effort makes Arab Americans somehow suspect and could lead to attacks against them. And today, Mark Pelevin of the American Jewish Congress seconded that viewpoint.
A threat to any group can indeed turn into a threat to any other group. It's important to be very vigilant.
Both Arab and Jewish groups have been wary of an increase in hate crimes since the Gulf crisis began. And despite disagreements on the Israel-Palestine question, it appears that this may well be the first in a series of joint efforts between the Arab and Jewish communities in the United States on domestic issues raised by the Gulf War. I'm Michael Richards in Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 16 points today to close at 2,619. This is NPR News. Soviet troops seized another building in Lithuania today, taking over the Baltic Republic's main warehouse for paper and printing supplies. There was no report of violence during the takeover, but Lithuanian officials say the Communist Party now has virtually complete control of the press. Lithuanian President Vytautas Landsbergis told the Republic's parliament that Moscow must return all seized buildings before a dialogue can be resumed. President Bush granted Mongolia most favored nation trade status today and promised expanded economic assistance to the emerging republic. President Bush welcomed the president of Mongolia to the White House this afternoon. It's the first visit by a Mongolian head of state since the Communist Republic was created in 1919. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Although its significance was buried under Persian Gulf developments, the meeting between President Bush and Mongolian President Okerbat was an historic moment. For 70 years, Mongolia, an empire founded by Genghis Khan in the 13th century, has lived under the shadow of the Soviet Union as a communist state. 6 months ago, it held its first democratic elections. Mongolia is now trying to wean itself of Soviet aid by opening trade and investment with the West. President Bush hailed the visit and praised Mongolia's positive approach to reform. President Okerbat emphasized the need for economic cooperation. The two leaders signed a bilateral trade agreement and approved joint efforts in science and technology. U.S. trade with Mongolia now totals just under $2 million a year, but under the new agreement, tariffs will be greatly reduced on Mongolian products to increase two-way commerce. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
There was new fighting reported today in the Central African nation of Rwanda. The conflict began in October when Rwanda was invaded by a group of fighters who'd been living in exile in neighboring Uganda. That offensive was eventually driven back by government forces. Foreign diplomats said today that members of the same rebel group apparently attacked a district capital. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, Israel was hit by an Iraqi Scud missile. It was the third and worst of the Iraqi missile attacks on Israel. Iraq's ambassador to the UN said that his country attacked Israel because inflicting the pain and suffering of war on Israelis might lead them to reach a settlement with the Palestinians. Saddam Hussein is trying to turn his acts of aggression into acts championing the Palestinian cause. How and why did the Palestinians align themselves with Saddam Hussein? And what are the controversies among Palestinians about this alliance? Earlier today, we called Rashid Khalidi, the associate director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Chicago. He's the author of several books about the Palestinians and the editor of a forthcoming anthology on the origins of Arab nationalism. I asked him when the Palestinians aligned themselves with Iraq.
The Palestinians actually began to align themselves with Iraq well before the Gulf conflict began, well before the invasion of Kuwait. I think it's probably datable to sometime early this year when it became apparent that the Palestinian peace offensive had pretty much failed, that it had not elicited anything in the way of a response either from the Israeli government or from the Bush administration. So what began to happen, and you could see this going on through the spring, was that Palestinian public opinion was growing increasingly dissatisfied. The Intifada was not having much of an effect on the Israeli government. It was having an effect on Israeli public opinion, but the government was still intransigent. And the PLO found itself under enormous pressure from the Islamic fundamentalists, in particular from Hamas. So I think as a way of responding to this pressure from below and to the failure of their diplomatic strategy, the PLO began to move closer to Iraq. And there was a lot of dissension within the organization about this, but there's no question that this is a drift that began 8 or 10 months ago, maybe even longer ago.
It seems there's a division within the mainstream of the Palestinian movement over whether they should be siding with Iraq or not.
There is, in fact, division. And there's been an intense debate, which we've heard very little about, but which, if you follow the Arabic press, is very apparent, between people who have argued that the PLO should have tried, to whatever extent possible, to maintain a much more neutral stance in this conflict, and others who have advocated a forthright support of Iraq, in keeping with the feeling of much of Palestinian public opinion, which has tended to sympathize with Iraq, not necessarily over the issue of Kuwait, but over, in particular, its standing up to the United States.
Now, I was reading some speculation in the American press that the reason why Yasser Arafat of the PLO sided with Iraq was because he had outraged Syria by moving toward peace with Israel, and then in return for being willing to negotiate, he got little or nothing from the United States, and that kind of led him into the Iraqi camp. What do you think about that explanation?
Well, there's a lot to it, I think, and I would basically agree with that. The PLO leadership went out on a limb in the last few years trying to meet American conditions and trying to appeal to Israel, or to at least Israeli public opinion, to initiate a negotiating process. And they were stonewalled. There can be no question that the Bush administration paid absolutely no attention to what they had done and tended to focus entirely on Shamir and Israel and what they would accept in the way of a settlement process, which turned out, of course, to be nothing whatsoever. As a result, the PLO had risked a great deal and achieved nothing and was extremely vulnerable. So this was part of a broader situation where the PLO was isolated from a number of Arab countries like Syria, was disappointed with the efforts of others like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, which showed no willingness to exert any serious efforts to get the U.S. administration to take the issue of an Arab-Israeli settlement seriously, and was finally under pressure from its own public opinion to do something, for heaven's sakes. And in this circumstance, the Iraqis acted very shrewdly and basically pushed and pulled the PLO closer to them.
What did Arafat have to gain by getting into an alliance with Iraq?
Well, sometimes many people have argued it's hard to see what he could possibly have gained. And it's easy to see the disadvantages. An alignment with Iraq means isolation from other countries in the Arab world. An alignment with Iraq, even before this crisis started, we're talking about something that has been going on since before August 2nd. An alignment with Iraq, even before August 2nd, meant pretty much abandoning any possibility of dealing with the United States. But in the last analysis, PLO leaders are politicians who have to respond to a domestic constituency, and they have no firm ground on which to stand. They're all outside of occupied Palestine, of the occupied territories. They are all dependent, one way or another, on some Arab country in which to locate themselves. And in a situation where Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Syria were hostile or indifferent in varying degrees, the choice was between countries that are far away, weak, and ineffectual, like Tunis, which has been attacked now three times, or where there have been three different kinds of attacks on PLO leaders, Yemen and Algeria, which are extremely far away, and Iraq. So you have to see it in terms of domestic considerations, Palestinian political domestic considerations. You have to see it in terms of which Arab country can the PLO take refuge with, almost. And finally, I think you have to see it in terms of an increasing turn away from a logic of beseeching the United States. Palestinians have felt that over the last 3 or 4 years, they have sort of been down on their knees begging people to negotiate with them, and that there has been no response. I don't know that people in Israel or the United States necessarily see it that way, but there is an impression that the time has passed for this, that it has gotten nothing, and that maybe the kind of muscled approach that Saddam was putting forward was more appropriate. And you've got to remember, the Iraqis are not necessarily seen in the Arab world as they're seen in the United States. They're seen as advocating a course of deterrence and strength. The threats that they have made to Israel are not read in quite the same way in the Arab world as they are in this country. And many people were attracted to that posture, even though many others said this is purely cynical and opportunistic on the part of the Iraqis. They're just playing the Palestine card. They don't really have any concern for the Palestine issue. And I think most Palestinians, even those who support Iraq, in their heart of hearts, believe and know that to a large extent it is cynical and opportunistic on the part of the Iraqis.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Rashid Khalidi, who is the Associate Director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Chicago. He's also written extensively about Palestinians. I'm wondering if there is a debate now over the alliance between Palestinians and Iraqis, a debate within the Arab American intellectual community. And I want to quote something that Walid Khalidi was quoted as saying in the New York Times recently, and he's one of the leading Arab American intellectuals and has written also a lot about Palestinians. And he was quoted as saying, "The principles violated by Saddam and his invasion of Kuwait were the very principles from which the Palestinian cause drew its moral strength. Even if moral considerations were not at issue, and they are, antagonizing more than half the Arab states, particularly those that have enabled the PLO to operate for the last quarter of a century, is hardly in the Palestinian interest. And he went on to say the PLO's failure to come out publicly, repeatedly, and forcefully against the invasion of Kuwait in favor of Iraqi withdrawal in accordance with the UN resolutions has gravely damaged its political credibility and international standing. Do you think that there's a debate about these questions going on now among Arab American intellectuals?
I think most Arab American intellectuals, I think most Palestinian Americans, and a very large number of Palestinians would probably agree with every one of those sentiments.
Mm-hmm.
Most Palestinians were very strongly opposed to the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait and very strongly felt that it was absolutely vital for the PLO to stress that much more forcefully than it did. In fact, the PLO did come out with a variety of statements which were poorly reported, if at all, but they were too little too late, and they were clearly too lukewarm to have the kind of force that Waleed al-Khalidi's quote that you just gave us would suggest. I think something should be added, though,
yeah,
which is that even as Palestinians were opposed to the occupation of Kuwait, because they were opposed to any occupation, and just as Palestinians were opposed to all of the things that occupation meant, diversion of attention from other problems in the Middle East and so on, most of them did not think that this crisis had very much to do with Kuwait. Most of them felt that the crisis as it developed following the occupation of Kuwait, and particularly the American response to it, had more to do with issues of hegemony in the region and issues of the United States' relation to the region. And I have to say that stuff that's been published in the papers since the war has begun has substantiated this. I mean, Tom Friedman's piece on Sunday in the New York Times, Week in Review section, Andrew Rosenthal's piece in yesterday's New York Times, make it very clear that the president and his advisors intended, first and foremost, to take out Iraq as a power, and that Kuwait was a convenient pretext, but little more than that. And I think that's the way most Palestinians regarded this issue from the very moment that the United States began to respond to the invasion of Kuwait. They deplored the invasion of Kuwait. They deplored the occupation of Kuwait. They deplored the annexation of Kuwait. But they saw the American response as part of a much larger game that had absolutely nothing to do with Kuwait, and in which Kuwait was almost a footnote, a sideshow, whereby the United States was going to reassert its power, prevent the emergence of a strong Arab state with major military and strategic potentials, and reconfigure the region into a structure which more suited American interests. And most Palestinians, given the relationship between the United States and the Palestinians, given the relationship between the United States and Israel, couldn't be very happy about the United States doing that. So the problem was that most Palestinians, while feeling, I would say, almost exactly as those quotes you've read us indicate, at the same time were very much opposed to what they saw the United States as doing.
So there is opposition to the to trying to take out Iraq altogether, even though
exactly
Iraq is run by a dictator.
Well, precisely. I mean, the Palestinians have suffered a great deal from the Iraqi regime's policy on the Palestine question. For years and years and years, when the Palestinians were working in the mid and late 70s towards a policy of a two-state solution based on a negotiated compromise peace, the Iraqis were the most violent advocates of rejection and funded and supported the rejection front, and more seriously, funded and supported the Abu Nidal group, which was murdering PLO officials abroad who were trying to put forward a line of compromise and conciliation. The worst enemy of the PLO in the late 70s was the very Iraqi regime, mid and late 70s, was the very Iraqi regime, which is now posing as a friend of the Palestine cause. So that while at other times the Iraqis have been supportive of the Palestinians, there are no illusions among politically sophisticated Palestinians that this is a regime which has any genuine commitment of any sort to the Palestine cause.
What I don't understand is why are so many Palestinian Americans opposed to trying to end Saddam Hussein's military strength, since Saddam Hussein is a dictator?
Well, Saddam Hussein is a dictator, but so is everybody else in the Middle East. I mean, so are the Iraqi regime, the Syrian regime, the Saudi mm-hmm. regime, and so on and so forth, are non-democratic regimes. This is a problem that the Palestinians have to deal with. They have democratic politics, and they swim in a sea of dictators or monarchs, absolute monarchs. If the Palestinians were going to launch a crusade against every dictator in the Middle East, they'd have a long laundry list in front of them. the issue of Iraqi military strength is seen differently. And Palestinians see it as follows. The United States dominates this region to begin with. The United States has obstructed serious movement towards a compromise settlement. The United States is the primary backer of Israel. If the United States smashes the only independent Arab state, the only Arab state not dependent on the United States, not weak, not in one way or another tied with defense arrangements, tied with American basing arrangements, deeply in debt to the United States, or in other or otherwise incapable of independent action, the Palestinians see that they will be even less capable of operating freely, that they are, that their cause will be even less likely to be moved forward to where some kind of compromise settlement can be negotiated. Now, I don't really frankly think that a strong or a weak Iraq is going to have that much influence in the short run on a negotiation. But Palestinians all feel that this is an Arab country which is going to be smashed, not just as a military power. This is an Arab country whose major cities are being carpet bombed even as we speak. It's not reported here, but the second biggest city in Iraq is being carpet bombed by B-52s. People 25 miles away in Iran feel the earth shudder under them. So this is something that Palestinians also feel a great deal of concern about, as do I think most people in the Arab world. You feel the same kind of concern, I think, the same kind of concern is felt in Syria and Egypt and so on. They cannot see that what the United States has said its war aims are, which is to say the liberation of Kuwait, justifies the kind of destruction that this country is going to wreak on Iraq. So it's not just a strategic judgment. It's also a feeling of sympathy for the Iraqis.
My guest is Rashid Khalidi, the Associate Director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Chicago. Our conversation was recorded earlier today. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Rashid Khalidi, who is the Associate Director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Chicago. I don't know how much you've been in touch with people and how much you have your finger on the pulse of this, but I wonder if you could give us a sense from what you know of what reaction has been among Palestinians in the Middle East and among Palestinian Americans to the Scud missile attack yesterday on Tel Aviv.
Well, I don't know if I can tell you how people feel about it. It just happened yesterday, the one in which the heaviest casualties were inflicted. But I think you'll have several reactions. One is that people will feel that that the attention being given to the casualties in Israel is disproportionate, given that much heavier casualties are being inflicted in Iraq, and that that is where most Palestinians are probably. That is what most Palestinians are probably most concerned about. You've got to remember there are a lot of Palestinians in Kuwait and Iraq. There are also lots of them living and working in Israel and in the occupied territory. So they're concerned about both places and also about Saudi Arabia, where there are many Palestinians. So on a human level, I'm sure there's concern for Israelis and for Palestinians, Iraqis and Saudis and Kuwaitis who are targeted. But in terms of the media attention, there's probably a little cynicism. Many, many times as many Iraqi civilians are undoubtedly being killed as each bombardment takes place.
I think a lot of people feel that the Scud missile attack on Tel Aviv is going to really hurt the possibility of negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians for a Palestinian state, and that even the peace movement in Israel will be very alienated to a mild a term, I think, for how they're probably feeling after the Scud missile attack. I wonder what your projections are for how these attempts to drag Israel into the war and to directly attack Israel will actually affect the future of Israeli-Palestinian relations and negotiations?
It's a good question, and I think there can be no doubt that this whole conflict is going to affect negatively not just Palestinian-Israeli relations, but also the prospects for an equitable negotiated Arab-Israeli settlement. We've got to remember, though, we have a long war ahead of us, unfortunately, and many things will happen, so that the way people feel now, it's important, but once the war has run its course, and once these horrible permutations that we're all sitting expecting have come about, everything may look somewhat different. People's expectations will change, and ultimately, the only way for this region to have peace is for there to be negotiations. I mean, at the end of the fighting, whether we're talking about the United States and Iraq, or whether we're talking about the Arabs and the Israelis, they're going to have to sit down and negotiate. However much hatred has been rekindled by the bombardments of Tel Aviv, the bombardments of Baghdad and Basra and so on, and whatever other horrors this war may have in store for us, at the end of it, they're going to have to sit down and deal with each other and negotiate with each other. I don't think that the world can allow the Middle East to continue to spin out of control. I think that the kind of casual attitude which our government has shown towards Middle East peacemaking was a dereliction of duty. This is an urgent priority for this country, and it's an urgent priority for world peace, and we really ought to devote the same kind of massive resources to settling this to the extent to which we can contribute to that as we've devoted to making war.
Do you think that the alignment of the Palestinians and Iraq is ultimately going to hurt the Palestinian cause?
That's a good question. I think that the Palestinians were in a no-win situation, and I don't necessarily think that they had as many choices as it may look from the outside as they had. But I don't think that much good is going to come of this crisis or this war for the Palestinians, frankly. I'm very pessimistic about the outcomes. I don't know that an alternative strategy would have been possible, but I don't think that whatever strategy the PLO is following is necessarily going to lead to any great advantages for the Palestinian people.
It seems to me that Palestinians are in a very difficult predicament in a way in this war, since the Palestinians are a diaspora. They're spread out throughout the Arab world.
Right.
They're in the countries on each side. There are residents in the large sectors of Palestinian community are living on each side of this war.
That's absolutely correct. The people who are in the occupied territories are at risk from Iraqi bombardments as well as from the possibility of Israel taking reprisals against that population.
Well, there's 150,000 Palestinians in Saudi Arabia.
Then there are, in addition, well, there are more than a million, perhaps closer to 2 million in Jordan, which is a possible war zone. There are well over 100,000 in Saudi Arabia. There are well over 200,000 in Kuwait. And there are many tens of thousands in Iraq. So every potential war zone includes large numbers of Palestinians, all of whom are at risk. Almost all of whom are non-combatants, incidentally, but all of whom are at risk, and many of whom may be the victims of political reprisals, whether in Israel or in the Gulf or elsewhere. So the fear is not just of people being killed accidentally as casualties of war. The fear is also of pogroms and political reprisals as the war goes on or after the war.
Rashid Khalidi, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Rashid Khalidi is the Associate Director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Chicago and the author of several books on the Palestinians. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're 1 week into the war in the Gulf, and we've heard from military strategists, retired generals, journalists, and political analysts. Coming up, we hear the response of Arab and American artists to the war. We talk to poet Dabia Khamis from the United Arab Emirates. She was the first woman to be jailed in her country for her writing. We'll also hear a new poem about the war by Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Galway Kinnell. And we'll hear from Dan Wasserman, editorial cartoonist for the Boston Globe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, five Arab countries have formally asked the UN Security Council to debate the Persian Gulf War, but the idea has generated little enthusiasm from members of the Gulf Coalition. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Although the Security Council authorized military action against Iraq in November, it has avoided any direct involvement in the war since it began a week ago. Now, five North African nations, Algeria, Libya, Morocco, Tunisia, and Mauritania, have asked the Council to take up the matter to discuss possible peace initiatives. None of those countries sits on the Security Council, and it is not clear whether the request will be granted. The U.S. and its allies say they're willing to meet on the subject, although they say privately that they see no point to it. They say unless Iraq expresses a willingness to leave Kuwait, there is no reason for the UN to get involved again. And if he is willing to pull out, they say there is no shortage of peace initiatives for overseeing his withdrawal. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
And for the fourth time since the start of the Persian Gulf War, Iraqi missiles have been fired at Israel. Israeli military officials say in the latest attack, two Patriot defense missiles intercepted one Iraqi missile, and there were no casualties. Yesterday, three people died of heart attacks, and more than 90 others were injured in Tel Aviv during a missile attack. The nation's top military officer says the Allies will begin to move the focus of the air assault on Iraq. General Colin Powell, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says the goal now is to debilitate the Iraqi ground troops. NPR's David Mopus has more from the Pentagon.
General Powell says the strategy is simple, to go after the brains of the Iraqi ground force, the command centers south of Baghdad, plus trucks and roads that link troops with supplies, adding, we'll bomb anything that allows the army to function. As the supply lines are cut, Powell says the Allies will step up the process of killing the troops themselves with heavy aerial bombardments. We are just starting to do that in earnest, he says, and it's too early to make conclusions about the impact. Some units have hardly been hit, others have been hit hard, with 40% damage. Powell says the Iraqi troops are well dug in and not moving, using camouflage, decoys, and hardened bunkers for protection. We have anecdotal evidence that Iraqi morale is low and there are some defections, but it's not a trend, he says. I'm David Malpas at the Pentagon.
In London, Britain has deported 14 Iraqi students and detained 32 other Iraqi citizens. Officials said that those deported had been in detention before being sent out of the country. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 16 points to close at 2,619.06 on volume of some 169 million shares. Trading was active. This is NPR News. Officials in Germany say that exporters convicted of breaking the UN trade embargo against Iraq could spend 10 years in prison. The German economics minister said anyone found breaking the ban should be dealt with in the same manner as those who commit murder and homicide. German firms are alleged to have played a major role in developing Iraq's chemical and biological weapon supply, and some 80 German firms have been linked to possible violations. However, only seven are now under investigation. It's now official the U.S. is in a recession. And a recession is one of the things that can excuse the Congress and the White House from abiding by the deficit reduction agreement. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The Congressional Budget Office and the administration's Office of Management and Budget are now on record. They agree that the United States is in a recession. The economy has experienced two consecutive quarters of negative growth. According to the budget agreement struck last year, once the country is in a recession, the Senate must vote to decide whether to do away with its deficit reduction measures, such as spending cuts and tax increases. In the House of Representatives, such a vote would be optional. So far, the overwhelming consensus of leaders in the House and Senate from both parties is to leave the budget agreement alone despite the recession. And the administration agrees. Officials at the White House and Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan both say they oppose any efforts to renege on the budget agreement and its deficit reduction targets. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan says that the Fed might cut a key interest rate again in a move to stimulate the economy. In testimony on Capitol Hill, Greenspan said there is concern about the reluctance of banks to lend money and the impact that this is having on the economy. He said that again cutting the Fed funds rate would be a likely move. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In times of war, it is often writers and artists who give voice to our most powerful emotions, either in dissent or support. We're trying to find and understand voices from all different sides of this conflict. We'll hear from some of them over the next half hour. First, Dabia Khamis. She's a writer in exile from the United Arab Emirates, one of the Gulf states bordering Kuwait. She was educated in the U.S. and England. When she returned to her country in the late 1980s, she was imprisoned for her writing. Khamis lives in Cairo. She's lived there for the past 2 years. She's returned to her country several times to visit her family. But since the war, flights in and out of the United Arab Emirates have been suspended. I phoned Dabia Khamis in Cairo earlier today and asked her where her heart was during the war.
Well, my heart has always been shattered before and after the war. I guess part of it is that my home in the Gulf and part of it is here in Cairo. And the other part is probably in Iraq. I have never been to Iraq. I have never lived in Iraq. But I was saying from the beginning of this war, it seems to me while I'm watching TV and reading newspapers, as if my heart has been put on a plate and I have been eating it with a fork and a knife.
Can I ask you how your day-to-day life has been changed by the outbreak of war?
For the first 4 days, I was not able to sleep at all. I had to go to the doctor to get an injection to be able to go to sleep. We were listening to news all the time, watching CNN news, reading newspapers. Because I'm from the Gulf and I'm living in Cairo, I had been seeing a lot of hostile attitudes, but not any. They are not really expressed. Yeah, I feel as if we are blamed as Gulf people to what happened in Iraq. People are against Saddam, but also people, they do feel like I do. We don't want to see the destruction of Iraq.
You were the first woman to be put in prison in the United Arab Emirates for writing. Is that right? That you were the first woman whose writing landed her in prison?
Unfortunately, that's right, yeah.
And that was in 1987?
Exactly.
What did you say in the writing that was responsible for the imprisonment?
I don't think that they were intimidated by a specific article or a specific story or a specific poem. It was a trial based on why are you writing? Full stop, you know. They did burn some of my books at that time, but when they kidnapped me and I was put in prison, they did not put me in prison for a certain writing. It was for everything I wrote and everything I wanted to write and everything I probably would write in the future.
Can I ask you to read one of your poems? And I think you've translated one into English. I'm going to ask you to read it first in Arabic and then translate it into English for us.
Medina Samita. Hulm. Ahlumu lawnan. Naran. Jidaran. Wa nasiru fil hulmi ala habbat al-turab. a silent city, a dream. I dream of colors, fire, a wall, and in this dream, we walk touching the earth.
Do you see yourself as part of a larger movement of Arab intellectual descent, or do you think that Arab intellectuals living in exile who are dissenters are cut off from one another? I mean, is there a sense of an organized movement of Arab intellectual descent?
So. I don't think so, Terry, unfortunately. Maybe in the 60s, but I'm 31 years old, and probably the generation who were before me had this kind of movement, but we are the products of the defeats from 1967 to 1991. I think after the collapse of Beirut, Lebanon, and after the collapse of a lot of socialist movements in the Arab world, nationalist movements, there is no longer this kind of trend. Probably people who think the same, but they don't communicate with each other, and at the end, they don't really communicate with their society, leaving it to bureaucracy or leaving it to Islamic and fundamentalist trends. And I don't think it's just our government that didn't encourage that kind of movement. It's also the West that didn't want to see it during the 70s and the 80s. They were afraid of the Eastern Bloc, the socialist ideas, and they were afraid of pan-Arabism. And so these movements were fought very badly in the political level. I think in the intellectual level, there are writers who do write, but they end up either assassinated or living in exile or worthless, really, in their own society.
Do you feel that there are any particular obstacles that you are up against as a woman Arab intellectual?
Many. Many obstacles, Terry. I don't know where to begin. I feel sometimes as if I am not living when I am in the Arab world. I feel as if I am a shadow. And I don't think it's a matter of being a shadow to a man as much as a shadow to a whole society, to other women as well. And I get very, very frustrated, and this frustration lately, during the last few years, it does reflect itself over my body. So I do start feeling sick, and feeling depressed, hopeless, etc. There are many obstacles, and these obstacles, they don't really stop at the political level only. I, for example, have been unemployed for the last 3 years. I have not been able to make a good personal relationship with a man for the last few years for the same reason. There are so many obstacles. Somehow you become as if you are a deceased person.
When was the last time you were in the country of your birth, the United Arab Emirates?
Last year. I was there last year after an absence of 3 years. I went to visit and to see my mother and to see if I can still be able to work or live there.
And were you?
Not really, no. But still, I'm trying. Not giving up yet.
Writer and poet Dabia Khamis. I spoke with her earlier today from Cairo. In this country, artists are also contributing to the Gulf debate. A poem by Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Galway Kinnell. After the short break, this is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Galway Kinnell is spending the month at the McDowell Artist Colony in New Hampshire. He told me he didn't think there would be a war in the Gulf, but hours before it started, when he realized it was imminent, he started writing a poem, and he spent most of his time since working on it. He usually doesn't like to read a poem until he's spent months or even years revising it, but with this poem, it's different, more urgent.
Well, you know, my thoughts were racing and raging, I should say, through my head. And so I thought, well, why not write them rather than suffer them? So I did write this thing in a great rush of outrage and sorrow.
Well, Galway Kinnell, let me ask you to read this poem that you've written, which is called This War.
Yes, well, I'm going to... The poem is in a very rough draft. I'm going to read part of it and then skip over some parts that are really too disorganized to read on the radio, and then I'll read the very ending of the poem. It's called This War. In the Baghdad Bazaar 35 years ago, I was bargaining for a big silver samovar. The merchant and I talked it over a long time in the kerosene glare. He was older and seemed a little reckless, like my brother. And he seemed to like me, but to love the samovar. He would not come down much, and being poor, I would not go up much. Finally, we shook hands and laughed at it all, and I walked away. For a moment, as I walked away, I imagined he might call after me, "Wait." But then I knew he would not. They have sent missiles and planes, and they have found the radar installations and the control centers, and they bomb them. They have found the missile sites and the air bases, and they bomb and bomb them. They have found planes on the ground and bomb them. They are trying to bomb the planes in the hardened hangars under the ground. They have found the nuclear weapons plants and the chemical weapons plants, and they bomb them. B-52s saturation bomb the massed troops. Soon helicopters with Gatling guns will come and machine gun the troops. Soon Bradley fighting vehicles and M1A1 tanks with armor-piercing weapons will grind their way toward other tanks with armor-piercing weapons. Soon soldiers will jump from personnel carriers. Run, fall flat, shoot, rise, run, get shot, fall, shoot, rise, get shot. This is the battle plan. This is the order of slaughter. It could be there are generals who like this war as a method of weapons testing. It could be the chiefs of the marketing divisions of the weapons industry like the war as a showcase for the merchandise. It could be there are thwarted, angry people who like it because it is a real war and gives them a break from imaginary killing. It could be unjust to say there are television executives who believe this war would be good for business if only the beer companies would see the potential in the slots following shots of soldiers trudging over hot, dry sand. The troops do not think this is good business. They are slightly excited. Adrenaline is the substance that makes wars fightable. They are also afraid, and they know they will be more afraid before Ramadan and the Ides of March have come. I am afraid, and I am sitting beside a fire in a cabin in New Hampshire with snow outside and a forest. A hand from below the bottom of my heart reaches up and clutches at it. I am afraid there are people who lie bleeding and dying or exploded in pieces or who are getting carried away in litters. Not only ours, but theirs too. The fathers and the mothers of children and the sisters and the brothers of children and the children. I do not think we can alter these events that broke the night after the night of the birthday of Martin Luther King. Once started, the fighting must run its course. All of us hope it runs it quick, but quick or slow, each of us must earn the right to look our children in the eye.
I want to ask you about the image in the first
in the first verse about bargaining with a merchant in Baghdad for a samovar.
Yeah.
You know, I've read some political columns where people are saying it's like, you know, unfair to characterize Saddam Hussein as you know, a crazy rug merchant who is trying to bargain us down. That's kind of like ethnic stereotyping in a way. And I wonder, in the light of that, how you feel about that image, you know, and how you work through an image like that, you know.
Well, it's true that one, you know, there is the cliche of the bazaar at the heart of much of our thinking about Middle Eastern countries. But, you know, actually the bazaar is the center of much of the commercial life in those cities. And I think of the bazaar as a wonderful place. However, in this case, you know, I always had that hope that that this was a kind of a negotiation of the kind that one might make over a samovar, and that at the last minute, Saddam Hussein would step forward and say, "Wait, come back. You can have the samovar." But of course, in this opening section of the poem, the speaker realizes that this is not that the war is not a bargaining over an item in a bazaar.
Poet Galway Kinnell joins us from WEVO in Concord, New Hampshire. A talk with political cartoonist Dan Wasserman after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, we're 1 week into this war, and today the Secretary of Defense held a briefing. What do you have on that?
The Secretary of Defense was cautiously optimistic. It was a long and interesting briefing. General Colin Powell was there, too, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We'll have more on that briefing. Also, we'll take a look at things from the Iraqi side, talking to a diplomat, talking to refugees coming out of Iraq, some speculation on what conditions in Baghdad might be like with the water and power limited. We're also going to take a look at possible strategies for a land war if one starts.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Dan Wasserman is a political cartoonist who says he was in shock when the war broke out, feeling outrage and despair. But now he's beginning to find the dark humor in the war. I called him at the Boston Globe, where he's the editorial cartoonist, and I asked him to tell us about the first cartoon he drew after he heard the news.
Well, I heard on the radio driving home from the paper that the bombing of Baghdad had begun, and I turned around and went back into the paper and watched the first announcements. And ended up doing a cartoon of a sad, beleaguered-looking dove in the foreground against a background of bombing raids and explosions and missiles firing. Looking, and the dove is looking out to the viewers, saying, "This is a new world order." So that was my opening salvo on the opening salvos.
Are you having any problem in figuring out what might be considered in bad taste by your readers? Or, you know, what might be very funny but might be offensive on some level or just really ring the wrong note for people who have loved ones in the Gulf or whatever?
Yeah. No, I think about that a lot.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to be able to criticize the prosecution of the war, either by the politicians or the military, without implying in any way that you're disrespectful of the sacrifices that people in the armed forces are making or unsympathetic to the kind of pain that this is causing people. One of the things that's bothered me is that people don't seem to register, or not everybody, but few people seem to register that having to start this war was a colossal failure. And a lot of what upsets me about the fact that we've had to take this route as a country is exactly that a lot of people are going to die. So I keep that in mind, and I'm not sure were I a family member or someone serving over there that I would look at my work and be happy about it, but I'm sensitive to that consideration.
I think for any artist, one of the things you really try to get to is what you honestly believe. And what you honestly believe can sometimes really surprise you. I wonder if there's anything that's really giving you trouble with this war, trouble in figuring out what you really make of it, what you really think, if you're surprised at how you think about anything so far.
Yeah, no, that's a good question, and I definitely have been surprised. And I find that I have arguments with myself constantly about what we as a country should be doing. I mean, there's no question but that Saddam Hussein is an evil character. So I go back and forth. I could actually make a strong case for why this war is a good idea. And I do that in order to make sure that I've sort of covered that argument. In a more visceral way, I've been surprised by my reaction to the missile attacks on Israel. And the night of those first attacks, I was very upset and moved by these civilians being bombarded by Hussein's missiles. In a similar way, the POWs, watching these guys being forced to read these statements is just wrenching. So it's sometimes difficult to not go immediately from that sense of sympathy and outrage to saying, well, of course we should be doing this. You know, this guy's got to be stomped on. But it's definitely been a surprising experience sorting all this stuff out day to day.
Dan Wasserman is the editorial cartoonist at the Boston Globe. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our theme music is composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk to a representative of the World Watch Institute about the effect of this war on the world's environment. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.